Women in Science Club provides support for female undergraduates in science fields. Our club has three pillars: mentorship, building community, and connecting people. We offer networking events with alumni, professional development workshops, as well as an ongoing mentorship program to support students through challenges that arise for women pursuing careers in science.
Hello, this is Tony Bardock of the Little Guitar Army, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. My name is Josh. This is the science episode today. First up is an interview with UBC Women in Science. There's a story by Britt Bachman, editor at Discord Magazine. Then rounding off the hour, we have Dylan Ferguson talking about food and innovations in cooking, science, molecular gastronomy. CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to right now is Codin, Baikal Acid. We'll be back with the feature interview after this break.
What's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And Valerie Chu, UBC VP Mentorship and the president of the UBC Women in Science Club. They are here to talk a little bit about what they do. Does somebody want to just start off, maybe you, Valerie, to just explain basically the foundation of the club and what it's all about?
Yeah, sure. So our club was founded in 2014, so we're a relatively new club. Our club is based on three pillars, so mentorship, community building, and connecting people. So for mentorship, our mentorship program is highly successful, and we aim to connect undergraduate female students with older female mentors. We've got tons of master's students, medicine students, dentistry, and pharmacy students, and we aim to connect those two in a mentorship-style format throughout the year so that students can have a mentor to guide them through their undergraduate years in terms of deciding on careers or classes or where to move on after their undergraduate studies. We also hold a ton of events throughout the year, and they're open to all genders. And our aim for these events is to help our members through with professional advice or to explore different career paths and connect with like-minded women in science. So we hold a lot of events throughout the year. And Indra could explain some of the events that we've held.
Yeah. So recently we had our Lunch and Learn, which was a collaboration with Computer and Science. And we had a lot of mentors there that were from computer science, and students got the opportunity to speak with them about what it's like to be in a career that's related to computer science. We've also had a professional development night where we had a speaker from Sauder come in and sort of talk about skills for your resume in LinkedIn. And we also have a new event coming up in January, which is our lab tours, which is actually a collaboration between our club, URO, Chibi, and Computer Science, where we'll be giving students the opportunity to tour about 5 to 6 labs and see what it's like to work in those labs if they would like to in the future.
And how did both of you guys get involved with the club?
Okay, well, for me, I've always been really passionate about helping women, not only in science, but in life in general. I previously volunteered at Vancouver Rape Relief Shelter, as well as Battered Women Support Services. And then when I entered UBC 2 years ago, I was looking kind of for like a community of like-minded women in science where I could connect with whom I could connect. And I found this club, Women in Science, and when I heard that they were hiring for the new academic year, I immediately jumped onto the opportunity, and yeah, here I am.
So for me, my first interaction with UBC Women in Science was back in January 2015, where I attended an event that they were holding in collaboration with UBC Women in Engineering. It was WISE 2015, or Women in Science and Engineering event. And at this event, like, I didn't go in with any expectations, and I've sort of been a hardcore pre-med since I started my time here at UBC, and I thought maybe I could explore some new options and see what other careers are available to me. And I honestly it was definitely an eye-opening experience for me, because I was able to talk to so many different females in different science-related careers, like nurses, dietitians, and even civil engineers. And it really opened my eyes to the opportunities that are available for me once I graduate. And I left that event feeling really inspired and motivated, and I wanted to recreate my experience for other students. And they were actually giving out applications for the executive team for the following year. So I grabbed an application, filled it out, and sent it in right that night.
I was wondering, Valerie, maybe you could speak just to kind of the importance of the club and what you folks are doing. I was wondering, you know, I think a lot of people would agree that this is a really important issue, the visibility of women in science. But if you could maybe just like lay out some of the problems associated and kind of what you're trying to address.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned visibility. So that's really tied in with our core value as a club. So we really believe in the concept of visibility and representation of women in science and women in STEM. At UBC, we do feel like there's kind of a gap that is between undergrad female students and older senior female profs or females in other science professions. So our club really aims to bring the undergrads and the older community together because we believe that visibility is extremely important and that it helps our members see, they can see themselves in these mentors and in these women who are extremely successful and established in their careers. One thing that we thought about as a club was or why our club is important. There was something that happened last year with a very established Nobel-winning scientist, and his name is Dr. Tim Hunt. And last summer, he spoke at a conference, and he's a life scientist, a biochemist, and he actually said this at a conference in front of millions of journalists. He said, 3 things happen when girls are in the lab. You fall in love with them, they fall in love with you, and when you criticize them, they cry. So I think as a club, we were really shocked to hear this from an established, well-known and famous Nobel laureate scientist. And we feel like it's events like these, microaggressions and big statements like these that make us realize how important our club is, like in terms of visibility, in terms of seeing successful women who are great at what they do. And we believe this is not only important for women, but for men and all genders as well, because it's important for everyone to see diversity and inclusion in the STEM field, because we feel like that's really missing right now.
Our goal of our club is to really just be inclusive and really give everyone the opportunity to sort of see what women have achieved in science and provide a platform for everyone to see that. We also always post about different female scientists, their birthdays, what they've achieved on our social media all the time. So definitely check us out at UBC Women in Science.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you both articulated that really well. I think that, yeah, these are kind of pressing, really pressing problems. I want to get back to kind of the recognition of women in the legacy of science in a bit. But first, I was wondering if you could maybe lay out the mentorship program a little bit for me. What does that look like? What are these sessions like?
So the mentorship program, the planning begins in May at the end of every academic year. And in May, we all get together and we sort of compile a list of all of the mentors that we know personally. And in addition to that, that we would think would be a really good fit for the program and would love to be mentors in our program. And it takes about the entirety of the summer, the entire 4 months to contact them. And we've been successful in increasing the number of mentors every single year as well. Last year we had 15, this year we've gone up to 20. So by the time the new year rolls around, so September, we already have all our mentors ready to go, and that's when we start promoting and advertising our program and opening up the application for students to apply and be a part of the program. And then in early October, we hold our Meet a Mentor event, and that's where students get to meet the mentors for the very first time, and it's a great way for them to network and really get to know one another. And at that event, we also get preferences from the students and the mentors, and we use those preferences and the application submitted prior to make a match. And then once the matches are made, this year we did it so that one mentor was matched to two students, one per academic term. And then once the matches are made, they continue on for the entirety of the academic year. But most often, even though our program technically is scheduled from September to April, these students end up keeping in touch with their mentors, and they are a network of support and guidance for them. And for the mentors, this is a really great way to give back to their community.
Where are these? Give me a little bit of a sense of who these mentors are. What fields are they coming from? Mm-hmm. Where are they coming from?
So most of our mentors do have a science or health related background. So that includes medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, physics, and master's students. Health and anything along those lines. For example, we actually have a mentor that founded her own pharmaceutical company. So we get quite a variety of mentors, those that are still students themselves in things like medicine or dentistry, and those that are much older and more professional and more established as well.
What is the general sort of reception been like to these mentorships? I mean, what kind of feedback are you getting from particularly the undergrad students that are being mentored?
The reception has honestly been huge, and this year we received the most amount of applications that we ever have, I think close to 100. So it's definitely become a competitive program in a sense. It's something that students really want to get involved in. And we do our best to accommodate to everyone. That's why we even changed it to two students per mentor instead of one student per mentor. So it's definitely something students are interested in, and it's growing every year.
And we've had a couple of mentees after the program tell us how much they enjoyed our program and how eye-opening it was to explore different career paths, because I personally experienced this as well. Going into UBC as a science student, you're not really aware of the multitude of jobs or careers that are available after your undergrad. Honestly, when you walk into UBC, it feels like the only careers you are aware of are like dentistry and medicine. So by providing this mentorship program, we've really allowed our mentees to really open their eyes and see the multitude of careers and professions they could have, not only in medicine, dentistry, and pharmacy, but in genetics and genetic counseling, in environment.
We also have some physics, a few engineering.
I was curious particularly about the computer science, and I know that Vancouver has a real, like, this kind of burgeoning tech industry, or at least they've been talking about it being burgeoning for the past little while. And I was wondering kind of what kind of context you can give for that industry specifically and for computer science, and kind of how that community, maybe the challenges that women face in those communities, in those fields especially.
Sure. So for computer science, definitely in North America, there's still a huge gap there's a huge gender gap, basically, for the computer science field. It's actually funny because I went to this talk at Science World last year as a representative for our club, and I actually found out that computer science, when the field just emerged, so this was, I think, at the beginning of World War II, it was actually women who were leading this field. It was the majority women who were starting this new field in computers and learning more about, like, computer science. It was actually when in the 60s, 70s until the present when men actually began to dominate this field. So even at UBC, I believe that the rate, the acceptance rate, or like the amount of women compared to men in the field is extremely, like, there's a huge discrepancy. So we've tried to really address that by collaborating with this other kind of a club on science on campus as well, and they're called Women in Computer Science. So I believe Aninder mentioned this previously. We collaborated with them on Halloween this year with a lunch and learn. So we had two Amazon employees, so they're both software engineers, both women, and they came to give a talk to women from any faculties. It was open to all faculties and was a free event, a kind of a Q&A session about what they do at Amazon, what's the daily work life like, how did they get to where they are now, what made them decide to go into computer science. So we're hoping with events like these and just by making this like an open and active discussion to really bridge the gap between the genders in computer science.
Before, when we were talking, we touched briefly on kind of some of the challenges that the club has faced as well, just in kind of maybe getting the message out and the way that sometimes it's misinterpreted. You spoke specifically about being on clubs days and having kind of people come up to you. Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, we did receive a little bit of backlash on clubs day, specifically from a group of male students. I guess they believe that our club was exclusive, but our club aims to really include everybody, like Valerie mentioned, from all genders and all faculties, as a way to sort of be a platform for women in science and not exclude anyone. So that's sort of the message that we're trying to get across, that this club, really anybody can join, anybody can reap the benefits, and we want everyone to know that.
Yeah, I think that that's just looking at the past kind of week at UBC too, or the past 2 weeks, I guess, and looking at some of the, the male rights group that have emerged and kind of some of the qualms that they've had or the things that they've brought forward, which seem really on some shaky ground, I would say. I wanted to maybe talk about the history, the kind of the legacy of women in science, and maybe that's sort of related in a way that this is a history that's in a lot of ways kind of subdued, or maybe people prefer not to talk about it, or that it gets kind of forgotten. And I was wondering if you maybe had a female scientist who you look up to specifically, or somebody in history that you feel has had a really important impact.
Well, for me, my role model is Dr. Mae Jemison. I look up to her so much. She was the first Black female NASA astronaut to, you know, go into space. So a huge milestone for women for women and for Black women as well. She's also an engineer. She also holds a medical degree from Cornell, and she's also a dancer. So I think she's like very multi-talented, super inspiring. I hope to be like her one day. She also appeared on Star Trek in the 90s, so super cool.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
So for me, it's definitely Marie Curie, and she discovered the chemical elements radium and polonium. And she's also the only person that's ever won a Nobel Prize in both chemistry and physics. And she did this all in a time when higher education wasn't very accessible for females. So to achieve so much with so many obstacles, I think is absolutely amazing.
So just as a kind of a final note, where do you see the club kind of going in the next few years? What do you imagine for it?
We just hope that our club grows, and it has been for the past couple of years, and the interest every year in our program and our events increases, and we always get a great response, and we hope to just improve with all the feedback that we get as well from students and mentors, and just make our club bigger and better.
I see our club's mentorship program expanding like exponentially every year. I also hope to see more collaborations between our club and other clubs to get our club out and to make sure that women, both female and male science students and STEM students know that we're here and that we're here for you. Yeah.
Great, Ananda and Valerie, it's been a real pleasure talking.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hey, you're listening to Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. This is the science episode. We are broadcasting live from UBC, the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. I'm here today for this middle storytelling segment with Britt Bachman, who is the editor of Discorder magazine. Hello, Britt.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great. It's been snowing out here. There's still some snow on the ground. The sky is really nice. You were just listening to Robbie Basha's Blue Crystal Fire before the intro to this segment. And Britt has a story that is kind of about weird science, crystal science, maybe. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah. I do want to mention, though, that there is a bit of a trigger warning to this story with sexual assault.
Right. Trigger warning for sexual assault for this segment coming up.
Yes. But I will tell you about it. It does have funny aspects to it. I come from Kelowna, British Columbia, and several years ago I was dating somebody named Sam who had a very huge and significant accident before we started dating. And he fell during a wedding reception and hit his head on some concrete and lost the use of his legs. Could not see either. He was blind as well.
That's really horrible.
It was really horrible. I mean, I say that. I didn't know him at the time. I knew his sisters, which is how we ended up meeting. But Western medicine had said that it was a very serious concussion and that there wasn't any way of treating it that could guarantee the use of his legs again or his eyesight. And so his family researched alternative methods of healing, and they determined there was this sensory deprivation experience that you could go through where they put you in a very dark room and your brain is essentially, certain aspects of it are turned off so that your body can focus on healing the aspects that it needs to heal. So I met Sam about a month after he got out of this sensory deprivation experience, this darkness, and he had been in there for, I forget the exact amount of time, it was anywhere between like 4 and 5 months.
So a significant amount of time.
A significant amount of time where his family was bringing him food and helping him use the washroom and all that. And slowly the use of his legs, feeling in his legs came back. Wow. And his eyesight came back fully.
And how old was he? How old were you?
He was, I want to say like 26 maybe, and I was maybe 23 or something like that. So still very much in our 20s.
Right.
Yeah. And so I met him as this charismatic hippie persona. Very popular, very loved. We met at a yoga studio, actually, okay. Through his sisters. His entire family was very much into crystals, and after this experience, alternative medicines.
So they got, I bet they got more into it.
Oh, yeah. They got way more into it.
This
they
is
were
like
making
a miracle.
Kombucha. They were, yeah, it was a complete miracle. And the way they would talk about it, they would phrase it in the context of the flow of the universe, of... of course this happened. This is the way it was supposed to happen. This is the way all these things happen, you know? So wow. I felt really loved in that circle because I met him, we hit it off, and immediately Sam and I were a thing. And people knew of us as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the family really, like, they really accepted me in a way that they were talking about retreats we were going on. They would give me crystals to carry around for safekeeping, you know. They
wow.
Yeah, it was very new agey, but very loved, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of bonfires, and there was a lot of community, a lot of fellowship within this. And it was the first time that I was involved in a very hippie community, though I am from the West Coast of Canada. I'm from here. So I did feel very loved.
And it was really like this philosophy too, which kind of got embodied in his healing.
Exactly. It was a way of life. It was a way of life that they took more seriously after his accident mm-hmm. and after he was healed.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly as we started dating, I started to learn more about how he was before the accident.
Okay.
And though his family was... you know, into crystals and into nature. Sam wasn't. He was a drug dealer, and he just lived a very different lifestyle. Mm-hmm. His fashion sense was mainly tracksuits. He styled his hair in a very different way than when I met him. His friend circle were quite intense. They had a lot of gang affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
And there were situations that just didn't really, I don't know, they didn't really fit with what my ideal of a mate would have been.
Right. And perhaps. This was before his accident.
This was before his accident. And I just knew these things about him and mm-hmm. started to learn these things about him. And it was very surprising to be with what I perceived as an entirely different
right.
person. Yeah.
How was the relationship itself?
The relationship that I had with Sam was, it was very spiritual. We did talk about a lot of universal mm-hmm. topics, a lot of philosophy. We did not have sex at all,
mm-hmm.
But we were still very connected, and there was an intimacy in that.
What was the reason?
Part of it was that he was really nervous about having sex for the first time after his accident, and also because he had explained that sex for him before the accident, he was worried that he didn't care enough about paying attention to his partner, and that was perhaps like a unhealthy vice for him. So mm-hmm. he didn't want to kind of risk reverting to that, or he just really wanted to cleanse his mind of those associations and make new associations by growing intimacy
mm-hmm.
with others. And in that case, it was me, and it was great.
Right.
And so yeah, we'd go on lots of adventures, and yeah, it was sexy mm-hmm. in its own way.
Yeah. And as the relationship progressed, did you start to kind of, I guess you got a sense of who he was beforehand. Did it kind of like, did his new sort of, I don't know, not persona, but like new embodiment, did that kind of stick around?
It started to dissolve sometimes, mostly around alcohol. So when we first started dating, he wasn't drinking either. But as the kind of the months wore on, we would go out for drinks in social settings, and he would have a couple drinks. And I noticed that he was a little bit different when that happened, or I did feel like he was a different person, like an entirely different person. His stories, he would tell them in different ways. It seemed that even his mannerisms were different mm-hmm. in some way. I never considered that he had potentially had a problem with alcohol before this, that wasn't even a thought that had crossed my mind. But there definitely was like a veneer that would slip
mm-hmm.
occasionally, but I never felt threatened by it in any way. And I guess I didn't really get to explore that too much before we unofficially or officially, depending on how you look at it, broke up.
Okay.
And he broke up with me to spend more time with his crystals.
That was the justification.
That was the justification. Sam had bought this set of crystals, and he said that hanging out with me was taking time away from the time that he wanted to spend doing self-care with his crystals.
Wow.
Yeah, well, when he first said it, I thought it was a joke. Like, I laughed out loud. And then when I realized it wasn't a joke, I was like obviously quite angry, but he gave me this wind chime as like an I'm sorry, I guess.
Okay.
I re-gifted it to my grandparents and they love it. But yeah, after that he did want to keep hanging out though.
Okay.
On a platonic basis, yeah. Which when you're not like having sex with somebody, but you share an intimacy, and when they want to keep hanging out
mm-hmm.
on a platonic basis, you're essentially just doing the exact same things you were doing before.
Right.
It was just like having a really close friend.
Yeah.
Like, cool.
And so how was that hangout with him? Like, I mean, things just continued. How did it come to a head?
Continued. Well, it just felt like we had continued our relationship, whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
His family was still treating me like I was whoever I was to them.
Okay.
You know? And then there was this one day that very spontaneously, I hadn't seen him in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
This was maybe like 3 months after we had this crystal breakup talk. And he had said that he was having kind of a fun day hanging out with friends and asked if I would like to join.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided yes, I wasn't doing anything. So me and Sam and a bunch of his friends met up at this beach, and we were swimming and having a great time. And he was drinking out of a water bottle, out of something that I assumed was water, but it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was moonshine, but like some like very great, like locally processed organic grappa or something, you know?
Okay.
It was like, it was fancy juice.
Yeah.
It was fancy juice. Yeah, I didn't realize how much of that he was drinking, and kind of people started to like trickle off throughout the night, and we migrated our like hangout, mm-hmm. I suppose. We snuck into this apartment complex and decided to go for a swim, like a skinny dipping swim, because mm-hmm. we didn't have bathing suits, and his brother was along as well. It was a full moon. It was a beautiful moon.
Right.
It was a super moon, actually.
Wow.
It was huge. It was a really nice night. And but as we were swimming, he became a little bit more aggressive and started talking about the light between us, and started talking about the connection between us, and about how drawn to me he was. And and he started being quite aggressive towards me and wanting to touch me,
mm-hmm.
which, like, we're skinny dipping. That made me a little uncomfortable, and I didn't really want that. So I you know, expressed that, and mm-hmm. he wasn't really listening to me. So he tried to force himself on me in this situation, and kept on, as he was forcing himself on me, talking about the light between us and why don't I see that and how do I not see that and how do wow. I not see that we're supposed to be together. And I fought him off, mm-hmm. and his brother, who at the time was in middle school, like quite a lot younger, did step in sort of near the end to help pull Sam away. And but I wouldn't have expected him to, you know, mm-hmm. Jump in right away. That's a lot for like a 14-year-old.
Yeah,
yeah. And so we had this situation, and Sam was quite drunk. I managed to get him home somehow. His mother came out and helped kind of bring wow. him into the house when I ran to my car and got in and drove away, because he was still like, he didn't want to be not near me. It was a very strange evening.
Yeah.
It was a strange evening. And in the following days, I definitely felt like that was not right.
Yeah.
I felt violated, and I didn't know how to process that. And in the following days, I needed to talk to him about it. And in a very sober discussion in the middle of the afternoon, he explained that he had tried to rape me because of the moon, because of the fullness of the moon, because of the spirituality and feminine energy that he was drawing from the moon.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was very much the same rhetoric that he used during his healing, during mm-hmm. The time that we had spent together, which was essentially like going with the flow of the energy of this and
new
blah,
age.
Blah, blah, and yeah. the new age shit. But in reality, I mean, he was acting in what I later talked to a lot of people and figured out were very similar to the way he acted before his accident.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
How was it being around Kelowna after that?
Not the best, because Sam is really loved. Everyone loves him. Everyone knows his family, knows somebody of his family. Everyone's bought kombucha off them. They are so perfectly loved.
Mm-hmm.
And when I shared my story, it's not that nobody would believe me, but everyone would say, oh, I'm sure you had like a really good reason, or that moon must have been really strong, you know?
Oh, so my God.
Was like, I know. Like, it's
oh,
good because I can laugh about it now,
yeah.
and even at the time, but I can be candid about it now.
Yeah.
So when people bring up that family with me and say, oh, do you know Sam? Do you mm-hmm. know these people? I can say, like, I do. I actually had quite an alarming experience about it, and I don't want to talk about it. Or, yeah, sure, we can talk about it, but just that you know, it does involve sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I have developed my own vocabulary for addressing it, so that I'm being true to who I am and not just enabling the character of Sam.
Right.
And even like Sam and I have had talks about it as well.
So you kept talking to him sometimes?
Yes. He, much to like the annoyment of my entire friend circle and mm-hmm. my best friend Corey especially, we have had some communication maybe once or twice a year
mm-hmm.
since then. He'll send me an email now and then from some point in the world that he'll share some weird universal tidbit
right.
about how we're connected or something and ask how I'm doing. But
that's gotta yeah. be difficult.
It is difficult. It's difficult to know how to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And so I usually just adopt the same language and mm-hmm. like, I don't know. I can slip into like hippie language pretty well, to be honest.
Do you have any explanation for kind of what happened? I mean, he has this like miraculous recovery
mm-hmm.
and then you have this happen a few months later.
Yeah, well, in the grand scheme of things, he went through a lot of changes in a really short amount of time. And I just happened to be there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to think that all of this happened within the same year, I mean, that's a lot to go through. That's a lot of, I mean, if we're going to talk about it, a lot of energy to repress,
right.
a lot of energy to, I mean, how can somebody change so completely in this small amount of time? I don't
mm-hmm.
know. You know, I think maybe that was a fresh start. I mean, maybe Sam saw this experience and this healing as a fresh start. Maybe he didn't think that he had changed, but he just wanted to change. And maybe I met him during this time when he was trying to express his idealized self, you know?
Yeah. Britt, thank you for sharing the story today.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. Britt is the editor of Discorder magazine here at CITR. I'm going to just leave you with Robbie Basho, Blue Crystal Fire. When we come back, an interview with Dylan Ferguson about cooking. And then after that, it's Discorder Radio here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Sunshine, smooth singing sunshine, wrap your blanket round me, wrap your blanket round me, round me, my love.
What's up, dude?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Tell me where you're at right now. You're at Save On?
I am at Save On Meats. Yeah.
How is the shift going today? Dylan Ferguson. A little bit of backstory here. A friend of mine who's at UBC just took a semester off. He's been working at Save On Meats over on Hastings. He's a cook, and he's a pretty darn good cook too. And so he's on for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment, talking a little bit about molecular gastronomy for the science episode here today. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Dylan Ferguson interview. I did it earlier today, a little over-the-phone interview while Dylan was on his break.
And it's going quite well.
Yeah?
Yeah, not too busy. The snow is keeping people at bay.
Oh, that's kind of nice, actually.
Yeah.
Tell me what you've been cooking today.
Well, today we've just been doing same old diner food as usual. Sort of, I guess, more modern takes on diner food.
Mm-hmm. Greasy.
Working with our good supply of meats that we have in restaurant. I guess one of the big perks of our work versus a lot of places is we have our own butcher shop, so we were able to use a lot more high quality cuts of meat. and usually get them for a cheaper price. So things like specials. We had a couple days ago, we did a cured pork belly that was really quite nice. A couple days prior to that, we did a really nice back bacon, slow roasted.
That does sound really good.
Yeah. Just doing a lot of cured meats and stuff like that.
What were you doing on Saturday? You're doing a community dinner too?
Yeah, so Save On Meats is one of the foremost providers for the SRO program in the downtown area of Vancouver. So once a day, we cook lunch for 800 people in 12 of the SROs throughout the downtown area. And currently we're looking to expand to do over 2,000 people and hopefully be serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner to the homeless
instead of
just lunch. So we'll be doing full meal programs, not necessarily for the homeless, I should say, for underprivileged living in SRO communities that might need assistance in terms of food.
Mm-hmm. So you started working at Save On when? At the beginning of the summer?
Springtime, around March of last year.
Okay.
March or April. Late March, early April.
And then, like, what was it that was, like, drawn? Like, you had some, like, kitchen experience, too. But, like, were you, drawn to food? Like, that time when you started at Save On, was it, like, because you were pretty stoked on food and cooking itself? Or was that just, like, it just started as a job?
It definitely just started. I did have kitchen experience prior to working at Save On Meats. Not necessarily a lot of prep cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So not as much working in cooking food as much as just preparing it.
Mm-hmm.
Save On definitely started just as a job and sort of evolved into a piqued interest in cooking and culinary arts, especially because we have the commissary at Save On Meats. The commissary is like a community kitchen.
Okay.
So chefs that don't have space to cook for their catering events or events, let's say pop-up dinners, will use our restaurant space to cook. And a lot of those chefs are quite talented and quite experienced in the culinary field. And so that, too, had a huge influence on beginning to understand and beginning to look at things outside of rudimentary cooking for restaurants or cooking basic meals, so to speak.
So it was like seeing that really good food going out that got you kind of into the possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was it, the kind of stuff that you were seeing kind of out there?
I guess out of Save On Meats, I work alongside, and occasionally I get to help out with some of the very talented like caterers and chefs from other restaurants in the area, such as like Wildebeest, Juniper, some of the more fine dining restaurants in the downtown east side. Just a multitude of variations on preparing simple ingredients, things that I'd never been exposed to before. I guess it'd be hard to pinpoint certain dishes that these chefs have made because I'm don't have full access as to what
they end up creating.
But there are certainly, you know, restaurants out there in the world that these chefs are trying to, you know, mirror their creations off of, and sort of they're contributing to this greater narrative on gastronomy as something more than just basic cooking.
Mm-hmm. What's one dish that you were like, or that you've been stoked on recently that you're like seeing that sort of, that sort of like complexity, like come like manifest, you know?
I haven't actually seen the dish in person before, but I've read up extensively on it and a lot of people have, and there are certain dishes that certain restaurants create, especially ones that are considered, you know, some of the best restaurants in the world that end up becoming almost their own entity or their own fable in terms of their importance or their sheer creativity in contributing to this sort of like culinary narrative.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big dishes I could think of is from a restaurant in Spain called El Bulli. El Bulli was a restaurant in Spain. It's no longer around, it was for a very long time considered the best restaurant in the world.
Mm-hmm. We're talking fine dining stuff, like real like.
Oh yeah, it was voted by the Michelin Guide, I believe, or it was voted by the Michelin Guide to have 3 stars, which is in the restaurant community the highest restaurant award you can achieve. They were also voted, I believe, by the Condé Nast and the Food and Wine list as the best restaurant in the world. Mm-hmm. So for a couple of years, it was unanimously hailed as the best restaurant in the world. And the biggest reason why they achieved that status is through this new sort of molecular gastronomy. Molecular gastronomy being taking the very compounds or elements of ingredients and sort of rearranging them, repurposing them to create dishes that are inherently unique at their molecular level, at the base level of creation. And so in El Bulli's case, one of their most famous dishes is called the golden egg, which is a dish that consists of has 3 components, gold shavings,
Jesus.
Caramel,
mm-hmm.
and a duck yolk. And the way that they create the dish is the duck yolk is wrapped in a caramel crust, and they use a certain type of glucose. I'm not entirely sure how they do it, but they make a coating in which the yolk can sit inside the caramel crust without getting burst.
Wow.
And then the entire egg is garnished with gold shavings. And this dish was like incredibly polarizing at the time when it came out, especially because for almost no reason at all, they just topped this dish with a lot of gold, which threw a lot of people off. And when they were confronted about it, they gave quite an eloquent response in which they related the dish itself to one of Aesop's fables, which is the goose laying golden eggs.
That's great.
And so the narrative sort of goes, you know, if you kill the goose that lays golden eggs, you won't have golden eggs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of just set the tone for their, legacy as a restaurant. They were always sort of trying to play off these jokes, these very inherent, bizarre factions in our lives, things that we wouldn't think are necessary that end up becoming quite necessary. Another one of their really famous dishes is called melon caviar. And it's a way of them, it's called spherification, in which they could capture liquids in ball form of whatever they wanted. And so they recreate a tub of caviar that looks like sturgeon caviar on the outside, but when you bite into the caviar, it's actually melon flavored.
Wow.
So that's one of the big things about El Bulli is that they're always trying to trick their patron, go to these great lengths to achieve really simple ideas inventive.
What do you mean, like, keep it in a sphere? How does that, is that related to the slow cooking stuff?
Yeah, sort of. So, like, it goes back to what I was sort of saying about cooking at a molecular level. You're using these compounds of glucose, these coatings on the outside that have these chemical properties that work to create very loose structures to liquids so that you can sort of mold these liquids into.
I'm thinking of like in space, like where you get these like ball, like you know when you watch like astronauts like in the space station or something and they have these like liquids and they just kind of like bubble and they're just like held contained but like they're not really contained.
Yeah, so it's a lot like that. It's like they have these extremely lightweight structure to them.
Mm-hmm.
The main ingredient in them is calcium lactate.
Okay.
And then you mix it with this other sort of, I believe it's called gluconate.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it mixes with water. And so when you drop your liquids into this water, sort of like you would with a poaching mechanism, they sort of suspend in air and wrap around itself. So it's kind of like, yeah, if you add on a basic level, like vinegar to a poaching pot,
okay,
and then you drop your poached egg in, the egg will sort of seal itself. And that's sort of the same process here, but obviously a lot more complex.
Okay, that makes sense though. The vinegar and egg thing, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, how are people actually kind of like conducting or coming up with these recipes? Because it sounds like you need like a lab for that. Like, that's really complex stuff. What's the process like? Do you have any idea what the process is like?
Well, the process for creating these types of things is literally like you need an army, and more so than just an army, it's sort of like having an army of generals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the more incredible things about fine dining when you get into the up. I myself have never been there, obviously, but from stories I've heard from chefs I've worked in at the commissary with, and from what I've gathered, it's just an extensive amount of knowledge of culinary arts to the point where you can begin experimentation at a completely different level. There's a place in Copenhagen called Noma, which is currently considered the best restaurant in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Noma has its own test kitchen adjacent to the restaurant, and that's where they have their experienced chefs spending like months and months coming up with very complex, highly inventive recipes. I think the main point, though, is that, yeah, it's an equal matter of having an incredible facility to test these things out in, which obviously comes from a restaurant's ability to garner the money, to build these restaurants. It all starts with the head chef, really, who obviously has to have a very vivid vision for what they want to achieve at their restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Rene Redzepi, who owns Noma Kitchen in Copenhagen, had a very, you know, strong philosophy to base his work off of, which is foraging and creating food that only grows in and around Copenhagen, Denmark. I think that it's a balance of limitations and desire to be completely inventive.
Mm-hmm.
You have chefs that want to create something that's entirely local and sustainable and evocative of the place where the restaurant sits, but at the same time create something that's almost otherworldly. So you have people then turning to the process of how they cook these things and just sort of going hog wild with it, like more or less trying to reinvent the very basic notions of what it means to cook an ingredient.
Tell me a bit about Noma. I think like Noma, like I think that a lot of people associate it with the like kind of Scandinavian, like, I don't know, what like food movement, food like revolution or whatever. Like what kind of dishes are they doing? What's kind of their philosophy behind there, other than just like this local and this like very like local around Copenhagen? Then like what else do they have going on?
Yeah, so Noma more or less created this philosophy of cooking that has started sort of sweeping first Scandinavia. Now it's become quite a globally renowned style of cooking, which is called New Nordic.
Mm.
Their philosophy is rooted in only using ingredients that are of the season and found within specifically Copenhagen. But for New Nordic cuisine, it generally means wherever you are cooking, you have to use only the ingredients around you. What's particularly interesting about Noma is they have unbelievably complex recipes. Some of them are